it's all kind of kicking off at the moment, isn't it? It's all happening. The Chinese and the Americans are having a trade war, yeah? The Americans fired a cruise missile last week, so the Russians are going to fire one this week, just to balance it up. The human race is just fantastic. And what else is happening? Oh, you know, the Brexiteers are fighting with the Europeans, and vice versa, you might say. I don't know. The Iranians are fighting with the Saudi Arabians, but they're fighting in Yemen, just not to be on home soil. And it's a long time since the Eurythmics sang "Everybody Wants to Rule the World." It's not just people who've been to Eton. Everyone wants to rule the world. And I look in despair. I look in dismay at the forces. I mean, I'm joking about it now, but that's just to kind of get you thinking, because it's frightening. It's frightening. And you're saying to, if you're like me, you're saying to God, wait a minute. This is a beautiful planet. It's a lovely world. And there's enough for everybody to be happy and prosperous and blessed. So why are we fighting? Well, it's because we're human beings. And this is what the human race does. And we're puzzled by it. And we're worried by it. And we want to know how it's going to end up, don't we? Well, would you be surprised to know that in Daniel's time, over 2,500 years ago, it was exactly the same. And Daniel was fighting with exactly the same questions that you and I are facing in our modern society. Well, things have changed, yeah, but things have remained the same. Who rules the world? That's what Daniel is asking himself. And in the midst of this, being Daniel, of course, Daniel has his own way of looking at these things. He has a dream. He's a dream man. And it might seem confusing. I will try to deconfuse you after we've read it. So let's go to Daniel 7. And we begin at the beginning. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Get up, eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. The beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. And while I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. The horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. But as I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. And I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Well, let's try and make sense of that. And I'm going to make sense of it by telling you about what I did last year. My son and I, Andrew and I, we decided we really wanted to go to the exhibition in the British Museum. It was on Ash Banipal, and if you could have my first PowerPoint slide, it was called "I Am Ash of Banipal, King of the World, King of Assyria." And it was about him. You probably haven't heard about him. But I want you to take you into his mind. Because as I take into his mind, although he lived 100 years before Daniel, it gives us an insight into the world in which Daniel, the prophet, was living. And it's very interesting. Ashurbanipal called himself the king of the world, and his empire was enormous. It went from modern-day Turkey, took in Egypt and Babylon and Palestine and a Fertile Crescent. The people of Judah had given up. Manasseh was on the throne, son of Hezekiah. He'd given up. He knew that he couldn't resist, and he gave in. Although Hezekiah had stood against Ashurbanipal's grandfather, who'd circled Jerusalem, but when he thought the city was in his grasp, his army died. They dropped like flies in the camp, and they had to go back to Assyria, and a few years later he was killed. And Ashurbanipal's father took the throne. And of course, the Assyrians never boasted about that. They had huge monuments to all their victories. But that one, all they said about it is, he said, I pinned Hezekiah up in a cage like a bird, which is kind of true. He doesn't mention my army was slaughtered by an angel of the Lord. He doesn't record that for posterity. Although when Herodotus, the Greek historian, passed through the Palestine lands hundreds of years later, people were still talking about that event when the Assyrian army died in their camp in their thousands, and nobody knew why. It's still hundreds of years later, they were still trying to guess what had happened. But Ashurbanipal reckoned that he ruled the world. He was very powerful, and he had no great challenge to his authority. But of course, he had to be a man. I mean, he couldn't be a weak king. He had to be a strong king. Now, the way they used to be strong kings in those days, they would march out to battle in front of their armies. That somehow never appealed to Ashurbanipal. It was far too dangerous, and he had other things to do. He had other fish to fry in his palace in Nineveh. But he had to do something. And I know this sounds ridiculous, but believe me, it's true. So he built a safari park outside the gates of Nineveh, and he filled it with lions, as you do. And it wasn't to drive through in his chariot and point out the little pussies. The whole point was to kill lions. So while he didn't actually march in front of an army, he could kill lions. And so he would venture out into Safari Park, armed to the teeth, with a small army of people around to protect him, just in case one of the lions forgot its due place in society and tried to kill him. He went out and he'd kill a lion. And he styled himself Ashurbanipal, the Lion Slayer. Okay? Now, obviously, if you're going to do that, you've got to put it on Instagram, haven't you? Yeah? Yeah, it's got to go on Instagram, and it's got to go on the internet. And that's what he did. Oh, okay. It took a bit longer. I mean, he didn't have Instagram. He had to chisel it out on basalt stone. And here we go. Here we are. Here he is. Can you see him in the top picture? Yeah, it's not. It's a bit light, but you can see him. He is slaying a lion. And on horseback below, he's slaying a lion. And in fact, a lion's been cheeky and trying to kill his spare horse, even. And he is killing the lions. He is the man. He is Ashurbanipal, the lion slayer. Are you impressed? Yeah, okay. Let me tell you one more thing about Ashurbanipal. And it comes up in the next slide, though you may or may not be able to see it. And yeah, but you can. That's Ashurbanipal on Instagram, all right? And he's got his bow and arrow. Let your eye go down to his belt, all right? And sticking in his belt, you see something. Yeah? Can you see it? That is a scribe's stylus for writing on clay tablets. Because he was very proud of his lion enclosure. But he was also very proud of his library. And he was equally proud that not only did he have a huge library with tens of thousands of books, many of them actually on clay tablets, but he read his books. In fact, he could read and write. And he not only had a library, he would browse in his library. He had read the books in his library. And he was nearly as proud of that as the fact that he killed lions. So what did he read? Well, I mean, you and I, we've got a few John Grisham, yeah, books of lawyers. We've got Ian Rankin on our library, yeah, a bit of crime, got a bit of that. Maybe a classic, yeah, Mill on the Floss, David Copperfield, yeah? Maybe you got any of those? I mean, some of you have very heavy books. You've got War and Peace. And Neil has Fury Analysis for Dummies on his bookshelf. I know you've got all these high-powered books. But interesting enough, we've recovered a number of the books from Ashurbanipal's library. And they're about interesting things. They're about medicine. How to cure gout. How to cure rheumatism. How to cure headaches. All medical things. And there's a whole section, massive section of his library, of how to predict the future. The ways to predict the future. And he read these books assiduously because he wanted to predict the future. That was his library. When he wasn't killing lions, he was learning how to predict the future. And one of the main ways he predicted the future was to get an animal, say a pig, and slaughter it, and look at its entrails. Now, you and me, if we slaughter a pig and look at its entrails, we think sausages. Yeah? In Ashurbanipal's library, it teaches you to look at a pig's entrails and say, there's going to be a general election in November. Because you are going to look at the entrails of an animal and predict the future. You and I would look at a calf's liver and say, bacon and calf's liver. They look at it and they say, oh dear, Donald Trump is going to fall out even further with China. They could predict the future. Now, this was still going on in Daniel's time. And actually, there's a funny little verse in the Bible which illustrates this perfectly. And you've probably jumped over it on a number of occasions. But just let me take you back to it. where Ezekiel the prophet is prophesying about what will happen when Babylonian army comes to a crossroads, and it must decide whether to go east or west, whether to go in the direction of Jerusalem or against it. And in Ezekiel 21:21, this is what he says: "For the king of Babylon will stop at the fork in the road, at the junction of the two roads, to seek an omen. He will cast lots with arrows. He will consult his idols. He will examine the liver." And that is what Ashurbanipal's library was all about: throwing the arrows down and analysing the way they fall. That will tell you what will happen. Looking at the liver, praying in front of your idols. That is what Ashurbanipal did. And that is how the king of Babylon, 100 years later, was still doing it. That's how the king of Babylon, in Daniel's day, was still finding out the future. And Daniel, of course, was a servant of the king of Babylon. But there are other ways than butchery to discover the future. And one of them is to have a dream, yeah? That was a very common way. So part of Ashurbanipal's library was about how to interpret dreams. Well, as it happens, in the Babylonian court 100 years later, they too had their department of dreams. Okay, there was a department of dreams among the wise men. And who was the head of the department of dreams in Babylon? Daniel! He's the go-to man for dreams. He's the head of the dream department in predicting the future. That's his job. So are you getting an idea of Daniel now? This is Daniel's life, trying to predict the future for his king. I find that helps when it comes to this passage. Is Daniel happy? Yes, but he would rather be in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem hasn't been rebuilt yet in Daniel's time. Has he become a great man? Yes, he has. He's become a national leader. He's in all the papers. In fact, he's probably got a column in the Times every day about predicting dreams. And in our chapter, the Bible writers are very subtle at times. You know, they give us these clues, and we've got to piece together what's happened. And if you didn't understand all this thing about the beasts, blah 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 blah, okay, go to verse 1 of chapter 7. Where we get a clue. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. Now, that's important. You and I, we jump over that. But if you stop and you think about it, it is actually very important. Because Belshazzar is the new king in the palace. The old one, Nebuchadnezzar, has died. Now, cast your mind back to how Daniel got on with Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan, authoritarian dictator. Dangerous man. Powerful man. But he and Daniel actually got on very well. Now, I know what he did to Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace. Yeah, but he got over that. He learned his lesson. He realized you don't mess with God. And Daniel, he has two dreams, if you remember. Nebuchadnezzar had two dreams in particular that he couldn't make sense of. So he called Daniel in to interpret them. And they were all about the future. Now this is where we come, you see where I've been getting to all along. They're predicting the future. And in the first, there's a series of four great empires depicted as a statue, a head of gold, the breast area of silver, and the bronze sort of girdle and legs of iron. It does have feet of clay. And these are four great kingdoms that are going to come. This is predicting the future. This is what Daniel does. This is his job. Okay, this is his job. And there it is in chapter 2, if you want to read it. But who's the head? Who is the head in his vision? Nebuchadnezzar. And what's Nebuchadnezzar like? What's he made of? Gold. So what's the most precious kingdom in this dream? It's Nebuchadnezzar. That's pretty flattering. That suggests that Daniel thinks that Nebuchadnezzar, that God thinks that Nebuchadnezzar's reign in some way is benign and is a blessing. The second vision he has is of a tree. And Nebuchadnezzar has a tree, and all the birds of the air come to nest in the tree. And it provides food for all and shelter. And who is the tree in the vision? It's Nebuchadnezzar again. All the immigrants of the world are coming, flocking to Nineveh, to Babylon. And they're finding prosperity. They're finding jobs. They're finding food. They're finding life. They're coming from all the different corners of the world. And they are living in this cosmopolitan city that Babylon has become. And they found wealth. In fact, the Jews are foremost among them. The Jews have found wealth and stability and security in Babylon at this time. There you go. Now, this is good. The problem is that Nebuchadnezzar is mortal and he dies. And Belshazzar takes over. And Belshazzar has no time for Daniel whatsoever. In fact, he pensions him off. All right? And in Daniel 5:22, we learn that he couldn't care less about God. Daniel 5, verse 22. Nebuchadnezzar had learned to respect God, but Belshazzar, absolutely not. Daniel 5, verse 22, if you're flicking through your Bible. And so Daniel and Belshazzar, they end up having a little bit of a confrontation. You, Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Getting the picture? So this vision happens when Daniel has been pensioned off and sent to his retirement home somewhere by a quiet river where he can fish and read the newspaper and have a quiet life. How happy is Daniel with this? On a scale of 10. He's not happy. He's not happy. Now, what happened suddenly is this vision, you know, of the tree and the head of gold has been replaced by what? It's been replaced by fighting beasts. And suddenly the world has become a world of great powers fighting each other that are depicted not as a statue or as a tree. They are wild beasts fighting each other. And it's frightening. It's meant to frighten. And Daniel's frightened, and the world has become like that. Now, change like that happens, actually, in the New Testament. Change like that does happen in the New Testament. If you read, and we're not going to, if you read Romans chapter 13, 1-7, Paul writes to the Christians in Romans, and he says, guys, settle down and pray for the emperor. You know, be at peace with society, pray for your society, and, you know, the emperor is there to protect you. You know, settle down, just be good citizens. But then Paul died, actually murdered by the Roman Empire. And you get the book of Revelation. And in Revelation, the beasts are back. And suddenly, what was benign has become aggressive. The whole thing's changed. And do you find that confusing? Well, I hope you find it comforting, because in a sense, what it tells you is that things change. Things change, but as we're going to discover, there's one constant behind it all. So nations come, nations go. In fact, what Daniel didn't know at this point was actually good times were coming, and King Cyrus was going to take the throne and pay to rebuild the temple. Who saw that coming? Well, Jeremiah did, but that's another story, another sermon for another day. So, We go through it. Now, I love the verse. I love the section in Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of Daniel, kind of just, but he was. But while Daniel was in Babylon, Jeremiah was in Jerusalem. And in Jeremiah 18, oh, it's there on the screen. Don't read it off the screen. If at any time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be uprooted, torn down and destroyed, and if that nation I warned repents of its evil, then I will relent and not inflict on it the disaster I had planned. And if at another time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be built up and planted, and if it does evil in my sight and does not obey me, then I will reconsider the good I had intended to do for it. In other words, there is a controlling power behind the rise and fall of nations. In fact, the beasts that Daniel mentions are part of the Babylonian mythology. They were figures that people knew about. And in fact, once a year, they had an annual festival in Babylon celebrating the fight between the beasts that created the world. It was one of their myths. So Daniel takes one of their basic ideas and said, yeah, the beasts are fighting. They're still fighting over nations, over land, over borders, over territory. But they've met their match. And here's where he turns it all on its head, because he then sees behind it, seated on a throne, is the Ancient of Days. And it's God who is controlling the fall and rise of nations. Yes, even Ashurbanipal, the lion slayer, his kingdom fell at the end of his reign, and the Babylonians defeated him in battle. They will all fall, says Daniel. One will remain, and that is our God. Does that help you in times of Brexit and world commotion? I don't know. It helps me to know that behind it is a God. There's one twist coming to the end of this. It's going to stun you, by the way. If you're bored now, you wouldn't be the first people to be bored. As Ian Coffey used to tell me, all the people who fell asleep in church were laid end to end. They'd be a lot more comfortable. But but the Son of Man, you know, he's there. And it's a kingdom. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Now, are you encouraged by that? That the kingdom of the Lord Jesus Christ will rule over every nation and every petty dictator. That encourages me. But there's a twist coming. A twist that nobody would have seen coming. And you have to go on to in chapter 7 to verse 18. But the holy people, now we're in Daniel 7, verse 18. But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. I'll read it again. The holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever. That's Daniel 7, verse 18. That kingdom I just talked about, God's given it to you. It's your kingdom. It's yours. That is your inheritance as a people of God. I'm not the first person to have read that verse in Scripture, of course. Five, 600 years later, there we are. Daniel 7, 18, 27. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms and the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Jump forward 500-600 years, and take you to Galilee. And there's a hillside. And there's this preacher, son of a carpenter. He's read Daniel. And he's preaching to his followers. And you know what he says? Do you know what he says? It's there in Luke 12:32. He says, "Fear not, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." Those beasts that trouble you in your nightmares, in your anxiety, they're not going to win. You are. Because the kingdom will one day be yours. You might feel that you're living in a war zone at the moment. But let me tell you this. Love will win. The kingdom is his. And he gives it to you. And you didn't realize you were that important, did you? As you walked into church this evening. But you are. That's God's promise to you. Yours will be the kingdom.